From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the Christchurch Cathedral's performance of Messiah.
I'll be enlightened about the 50-year history of the Circle of Lights.
And I'll take a look at a new book about artist Franklin Booth. And we'll have our arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. This year, Indianapolis area audiences have several choices of complete professional performances of Handel's Messiah. Sharon Gamble invited Dana Marsh of Christ Church Cathedral on Monument Circle to tell us about the performance he's conducting this Sunday at 3:30 at the Cathedral on Monument Circle.
So I know you've been here a couple of years, and you're probably feeling a little bit settled now. You had some really big shoes to fill when you took this job.
No question. Absolutely true. And certainly the reputation of the Cathedral Music Program did precede itself even as far afield as the UK.
Absolutely.
Having been brought in here straight from Cambridge University. And it did take, you know, one does have to be convinced to make that kind of a leap. But
you want me to go where? You want me to go to a city of 1.3 million in the middle of the Midwest? Why would I do that?
Well, you know, the interesting thing was our family actually for a couple of years lived in Bloomington when I was much younger. My father taught violin there back in the 80s. So and our experience there was fantastic. So and the first 4 years of my life were in Grinnell, Iowa. So I already felt somewhat at home.
You have the Midwestern chromosomes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So tell me about your background. What obviously your father teaching violin, you came from at least partly a musical family. Were you encouraged in music as a child?
Oh, absolutely. Both parents were musicians. My mother taught elementary music, Kodai method, and I ended up going away to school, choir school, actually the only church boarding choir school in the country, St. Thomas Choir School in New York City, on the church on Fifth Avenue. So I sort of 24 hours a day lived singing and actually spent the better part of a year also at Salisbury Cathedral in England as a boy. So I, you know, became very accustomed to the English tradition of 8 services a week with different music at each one. So I knew when I was 13, maybe 14 years old, that what I'm doing right now was exactly what I wanted to do.
And you probably had a lot of guidance. Someone took you aside and said, at some point, your voice will break.
Oh,
and then
yes.
You need to do something a little different. You can certainly continue as a singer, but...
Absolutely, and I did. Actually, in the last 4 or 5 years, I haven't done so much, but in the 90s, I sang quite a bit as a countertenor with American Bach soloist and with Leonhardt in New York, with New York Collegium, and so got very much into that side of things as well.
So singing is one thing. Conducting and shaping other people's voices is something quite different.
Absolutely true, and the tradition in Anglican choral music, up to really only the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years at the most, has been that someone who is solely an organist has directed the choir. And I think it's been useful to me to have had that experience singing and directing the choir here, and also in terms of relating to the boys and to the girls' choir, having, you know, been through that same training myself.
Now, this might be a bit of a curious question, but for a singer, the Anglican / Episcopalian, in local terms, church is kind of has the monopoly on great music. Were you Episcopalian when you were brought up, or were you drawn towards the music?
Well, it's interesting you say that. Yes, I was initially drawn to the music. When I was 6 or 7, we lived in upstate New York, and it was the local church choir, and it happened to be the Episcopal program that I gravitated towards. But I ended up making the decision myself within the next year that I wanted to be baptized. And so it was something that worked spiritually through to me through the music. And so it's really been a major part of my life ever since.
Fantastic. It's great when all parts of your life can be aligned that way.
Exactly.
In this country, before you went across the pond again, you were in Seattle for a while, right?
I was during high school. So after finishing up at St. Thomas Choir School in New York, was organ scholar at the cathedral in Seattle for a couple of years and went off to Eastman School. And then I worked for about 10 years in L.A. With a number of different choirs I directed, and then decided, well, gosh, you know, let's do something a little different. So I decided to do a Ph.D. at Oxford in musicology. And I spent about 11 years in the U.K. it ended up. I got involved in other things as well as the degree. And it was just an absolutely wonderful experience.
Any culture shock coming back to the States?
You know, not really. It's never any problem at all. And that's not to say that I didn't feel in some way almost transplanted over in the UK because of the amount of time I spent there.
Sure.
And the circles of friends, you know, you would just inevitably end up building up. But I did feel this to be something of a homecoming, and the last 2 years, though they've been very, very busy ones, have really been fantastic, and we're finding ourselves right now in a really wonderful place, and I couldn't be happier.
Fantastic. Now, for listeners who love Messiah but maybe are accustomed to... Well, we have a bit of an American tradition in music of thinking, well, if 2 voices on a part are good, 20 voices on a part are better. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, and I mean no disrespect to the choir I'm about to invoke, but a lot of people here grew up on the Mormon Tabernacle
Sure.
Messiah and the massed, you know, hundreds, what sounds like thousands of voices. If people are accustomed to that style of Messiah, help set the stage for the Messiah they'll hear when they come to hear yours.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the very large massed choir phenomenon, which, in a sense, even the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was emulating a tradition that also began in England in the late 19th century, where you'd have massed choirs numbering in the thousands performing Messiah. And there are some very interesting reviews that date back to that period.
Sounds horrifying for the conductor.
It must have. I'm just trying to imagine the tempi they must have been forced into.
Sure.
With some of these movements. But what we do really springs naturally out of the identity of the sort of choral foundation we are. And looking at the history, the performance history of Messiah under the composer at the moment when it first became popular. And what's often overlooked is that this piece was really, it really became famous as a fundraiser for children's causes. And that's, of course, a very important thing to all of us. And with the Men and Boys Choir, Men and Girls Choir, the men are all paid. Half of them local to Indianapolis, the other half either from the Early Music Institute at Indiana University or the vocal department. The kind of institution we are, which also inevitably is going to have a certain amount of turnover, is it's almost precisely the same kind of institution that sang those Foundling Hospital performances and Covent Garden performances in London in the early 1750s. It was basically the Chapel Royal Choir, which was Men and Boys Choir of very similar numbers.
Your soloists, regular listeners certainly know the wonderful tenor Stephen Stolen, who hosts a program here and has a day job over at the IRT as well that takes up a lot of his time. But Stephen has a bit of a reputation, not just as a singer, but as a singer accustomed to working with early music style or Baroque music style.
Absolutely.
Repertoire.
Yep. Yeah, in fact, I remember well back in the 90s at a time when I was doing quite a bit of singing on the early music circuit, Stephen Stolen himself appearing with Nicholas McGuigan's Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra in San Francisco. So this is not at all a new thing for him.
And the rest of your soloists?
The soprano will be Ellen Hargis, who is also a known quantity in the early music world. She's going to do a few of the arias. We're actually giving as many of them as possible to the kids. And this is another tradition that follows the London performances of the early 1750s, is that Handel did actually assign many of these solos to boy singers in the choir. So it's a great, again, it's sort of why it, for us, it's just a natural to do this kind of a performance, and you know, with the great support of the Indianapolis Baroque Orchestra.
Yeah, let's talk about them for a bit. What might listeners who maybe are accustomed to contemporary is always a problematic word when you're talking about music that's been around for 400 years,
right,
as we are with classical music, but audiences that are accustomed to a more modern interpretation, what mm-hmm. should they be looking for and listening for with the instrumentalists?
Well, it's a very, it's definitely a different sound. I mean, that's not to say that there isn't any overlap. I mean, it's not going to sound entirely foreign to people. One might say that the instruments, they're a little bit softer than the ones, you know, violin for violin, that audiences will be accustomed to hearing. However, they have a slightly different shape to them, and therefore, with their different sound, they have different limitations. And at the same time, they also excel at other kinds of sounds as well. And these limitations are the limitations that the composer had in mind when writing these parts. So there is a certain sense of kinship between these instruments and the music itself that I'll never forget the first time I heard it. I think I was 14 years old. And to me, it was a revelation. Not to say that I didn't derive the great, I mean, let's face it, Messiah wouldn't be here still if it didn't work in an enormous variety of presentations. But there was something about this and something about the intimacy of it and the ease of it that just, to me, felt very, very natural and at that age was a real revelation.
You're going to cringe when I say this, but in our music library here we have recordings of great Bach pieces on all percussion, all saxophone, and the astonishing thing is, if the music is good to begin with, it survives whatever you do to it, and sometimes you even hear something new.
Oh, absolutely.
If you hear it in a new way.
In fact, during the whole heat of controversy over the period performance practice movement, there were many sort of articles written back and forth in support and against, but there was always a unanimous agreement that there was something about the way Bach composed his music that could work across nearly any sort of milieu, medium of instrument, and there's something about the content of that music that remained intact no matter what, really.
Now, as we're having this conversation, you're deep into rehearsals for Messiah.
Right.
But can you give us a little hint at something you'd like to do with these musicians that maybe hasn't been done in the history of Christ Church?
Wow.
Repertoire-wise, recording-wise, performance-wise?
Well, sure. In fact, we've just released a disc that has just come out in the last week, and we have actually a new informational video about the choir program on our website. We intend to make this Messiah an annual thing, and it's very important to us also to do the complete piece. And starting next year, this is going to become a fundraiser for a children's charity in Indianapolis. So in that sense, we can conform as closely as possible to the circumstances of its origins.
Sharon Gamble with Dana Marsh of Christ Church Cathedral. Hear the performance they discussed at 3:30 this Sunday at the Cathedral on Monument Circle.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The question each year isn't if you're going to see the lights on the circle, it's when. This year the lights will stay up until January 12th as part of the 50th anniversary of the Circle of Lights. Travis DiNicola spoke with Jennifer Hansen from Indianapolis Downtown, Inc. about the festivities.
Jennifer, welcome to Art of the Matter, and happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.
Yes, absolutely. You guys have so much going on downtown, of course, this time of year. So many events, so many different activities for families and out-of-town visitors. But, of course, it all centers around the Circle.
Right, and we were just very proud that we were celebrating the 50th anniversary of Circle of Lights this year. And, you know, that event happened in November, but for the whole community, they can still enjoy it through the first of the year. The lights are up on Monument Circle, and it's one of the most popular places. I think people come down and have their family pictures taken in
Sure.
front of the monument all lit up. And it's really just a great tradition that we're so lucky to have for these past 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't go down to the Circle at least once during the holidays, right, to see the tree and
Absolutely.
Get your picture taken? I mean, I always love going, especially, you know, if there's snow coming down, and we'll see about that. But so 50 years, I mean, this is a pretty important milestone for this event. That's a really amazing history. And I know that you've been doing things through IDI to celebrate those 50 years.
Right. And the first thing is, which we think is incredible, is we have great partners with Quality Connection and IBEW 481. And the reason it's so incredible is because the electrical workers of IBEW 481 have been with us all 50 years.
Have they really?
They started in 1962, wow. And they were the ones that installed the lights the first time.
I mean, they volunteer so much of their time
Absolutely.
And effort to do this. And I was wondering if they'd been with it from the very beginning.
Yes, they started as volunteers that very first year. We've actually talked to, we have one of the gentlemen that was there for installation this year, and he was there in 1962 just telling some crazy stories about how he was an apprentice and they made him go up a ladder to change a light bulb that was already there. And he just has really funny stories, and he came back this year and just, he thought, this is amazing. And his son is now an electrician with
wow.
IBEW 481. So we've got some great stories, and they're just, both Quality Connection, IBEW 481, are just thrilled to be partners because they have cherished this tradition for you know,
sure.
as long as they can all remember. So that's really cool. So we definitely honor them. And one of the new things we are doing this year is, because it's so well-liked, we know that people out there have lots of great memories and photos.
Right.
And
right.
we want them to share with not only with us, but we've partnered with the Star, the Indianapolis Star,
mm-hmm.
where you can share your memories and upload your photos online, where you can show your
Now, is
pictures.
This through the Star's website?
Yes.
Or, okay.
You can get there through qc-indy.com,
mm-hmm.
but you can also get there, you know,
IndyStar.com
and,
then...
and Circle of Lights.
Sure.
But yes, the Star is constantly, as soon as the new photos are uploaded,
mm-hmm.
they kind of do a little... preview as you browse through the photos.
Neat.
You know, we've seen some pictures up there where someone's down on a knee. You see some, you know, engagements that happened during the Circle
oh,
of
sure.
Lights. Just family photos. And it's just really cool to know that people have experienced it. Could still be this year, your pictures, or it could be from, you know, 15 years ago when you first came for the very first time, or
right.
you brought your grandkids. So we're collecting those right now. And we'll do that through the end of the month. So people can still go online and share your memories about the Circle of Lights.
I think that's a great thing to do. Now, tell me a little bit more about, I mean, sort of how this has evolved over the years. I mean, of course, with the electrical union workers doing it, I mean, certainly the lights are probably different. It's not like if one goes out, you have to change the entire
right.
strand. And you know, but I know it's just some massive number of the bulbs and the people mm-hmm. and the man hours to make this happen.
Absolutely. You know, I started in 1999, which happened to be the magic year of when we switched the decor, mm-hmm. where it was time. In 99, it was time to replace the lights, and Indianapolis Downtown Inc. had done a huge survey of the community, and I think we got results from all over the world on whether they wanted to keep the lights, do something different. And the feedback was huge. They wanted to keep the lights, and there are 4,784 lights.
Okay.
And that's when we also added the decor of the soldiers and the candy cane sticks around.
Mm-hmm.
So that all happened in 99. And every year, the lights are maintained by the electrical workers. The retirees check the lights every October. So if one light goes out, luckily, you could just replace that one light. Now, but they do check every single one of them. I went out to the fairgrounds and watched them this year.
Is that where they do it? Because I was thinking about this, you know, as I was getting the lights ready for my Christmas tree this
right.
year, which are always just such a, you know, a spider's web, a tangle, a mess. And, you know, and I've got like two strands. And it's like, you know, and I'm looking at all those lights. Like, how do they keep them neat and organized and how they test them out? I mean, do they like lay them out over the...
They have it down to a science.
Yeah.
Each strand is kept in a big barrel.
Okay.
All numbered. And... I don't know, it's never tangled. They have it, and they actually stretch one strand out at a time. They plug it in. If a red's out, they replace it with a red.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have five colors. And it was just a science to see. They make sure that, you know, the electricians, they're there, and they make sure it's all ready to go. And they do, like I said, they do it a month early.
Yeah.
And then that installation is usually the 1st of November, where 200-plus volunteers come down on a Saturday and... It takes about 6 hours for the whole installation. They put it up. And I think the part that doesn't ever get advertised is when they take them down in January, it's usually freezing and snowing, and there's our volunteers back again to take the lights down.
It's still amazing to me. And I've you know come down there different times in the past, both for when they put them up or take them down. It amazes me how quickly they do it.
Right.
And they just work so fast.
They do. It's a team. And I think it's kind of cool because the apprentices are always able to join, you know, that first couple of years. And so they're learning, and then you get the retirees there helping too. So it's just really, you know, you see generations of, like I said, families that are there where the father and now the son are electricians, and it's always one of their favorite things to do.
Now, what about those big, the toy soldiers and candy canes? Do those get stored in your office?
Nah, no. Expo Design keeps those for us.
Okay.
That would be cool, though, right now, if we could just have one in the hallway or the lobby.
Sure. Absolutely. So, I mean, the big kickoff was, you know, right after Thanksgiving and when they're all lit and all that. But again, I mean, they are still up and they're great to see. Are there other events that are going on, whether tied to the circle or that IDI is involved with that you wanted to mention as far as coming up to the holidays?
Well, we do have a great web page. If you go under Visit Indy on IndyDT.com, it's called Holiday Happenings. And we put together, I think there's 9-12 stories about different things to do during the holidays, where you can see Santa, great ideas to shop downtown and shop local. Let's see, we've got all the holiday experiences. So if you want to know what to do with the kids, we've got what's going on at the Children's Museum with their Yule slide, and we've got the Indiana State Museum. So we try to think of everything downtown.
Mm-hmm.
During holiday break, when you've got your kids have 2 weeks off school, what can you do during those 2 weeks? All of that is under our holiday happenings.
Okay.
And people really love that resource just because it provides a little bit of everything for the holidays. It tells you information about Santa's mailbox on the circle. So
sure.
You know, drop your letter to Santa off and on the circle, and he'll write you back.
I'm always a big fan of the IDI newsletters and also just the updates of where the cherub is on the Ellis Ayers clock.
Yes.
Right? That's always, you know, 'cause you guys sort of always give a heads up, hey, it's going to be coming soon. And
because, you know, the cherub, we do manage that little guy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not looking in the right direction, it's very easy to miss.
Because he is.
Every time I, you know, happen over there, I'm like, where is he? Oh, okay.
There he is. Yeah, he's still there.
You got to just peek over the top.
So you guys are officially in charge of the
cherub.
Yes. It's a pretty cool thing to do.
It is. And that's another great tradition that's been around for like 75 years.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. Well, it is always a pleasure to chat with you. Indianapolis Downtown Inc., great not-for-profit that does so much good work in promoting the businesses and organizations and all the events that are going on in downtown Indy. It's a pleasure to chat with you. And thanks for all, of course, the work that you do with the Circle of Lights. And happy holidays.
Thank you so much.
Travis DiNicola with Jennifer Hansen from Indianapolis Downtown, Inc. The Circle of Light stays up until January 12th. The Share Your Memories program will run through December, and everyone's encouraged to upload old holiday photos, or new, to commemorate the 50th anniversary through the website indiestar.com/circleoflights. Again, indiestar.com/circleoflights. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
According to online calculators, there are 317,292,171 minutes of shopping time left.
What? Oh, my
and
goodness.
A few seconds too.
And that's assuming that the Mayan calendar is wrong.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, we can fill those minutes, or at least maybe 10 of them in that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
The Holiday Shopping
Edition. Yeah. What did I see the other day? Something about, well, if the world doesn't end on 12/20, it's 12/21/12, right?
Right,
right. A lot of angry people of Mayan descent will be frantically shopping,
doing their
the
shopping
next day.
Right, they've put it off until now.
That's right.
Well, don't put it off anymore. And don't put off going to see some holiday shows. There's
Absolutely.
A lot of great stuff going on.
Absolutely.
I wanted to mention Getting Figgy With It. It's a very Phoenix Xmas 7. 7 years they've been doing this of merriment and dance and comedy and music and
sock monkeys.
And sock monkeys. And this is not for the kids. This is definitely a fun adult holiday show worth checking out. Always hysterical. I can't wait. I'm hoping to get to it this weekend. Very Phoenix Xmas runs through December 23rd at the Phoenix Theater.
I have it on the good authority of Brian Fonseca, though, that there's no F in Christmas this year. So,
So
you would be safe taking your high schoolers, maybe even some adventuresome middle school kids.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. And they will enjoy the sock monkeys. Hey, speaking of kids, they can travel west, at least in their imaginations, on Jingle Rails, the Great Western Adventure. If you haven't seen this yet, and Travis, I know you've seen this because you're a railroad guy.
Such a
you're
great
railroad
exhibit.
Guy. But it's, the idea is it's a model railroad exhibit, but that travels through landmarks of Indianapolis on the way to great places in the west, including the Grand Canyon, Mount Rushmore, and Old Faithful. But here's the twist. These landmarks are just amazingly crafted out of natural materials, mm-hmm. bark, twigs, nuts, grasses, you name it. And they're exquisitely detailed and just these things are works of art on their own. So take your kids because they're going to groove on the trains and you can show them these models of great destinations. But you're going to enjoy it yourself because these are just amazing. It's called Jingle Rails, the Great Western Adventure. It's at the Eitelgeorg Museum.
Give yourself plenty of time to mm-hmm. go when you go see this because there's so much to look at and walk underneath and around and see, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Another great train exhibit that I want to mention is at Garfield Park. And that's also a great holiday train exhibit as well. Beautiful trains and really neat setups and layouts as well. Also worth checking out if you're into trains.
That's in the conservatory at Garfield
exactly,
Park,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, which is
yeah.
really beautiful. Hey, if you want to check out another Nutcracker, then the Ballet Theatre of Carmel is presenting a holiday of dance and the Nutcracker Suite this Sunday, the 16th, 7 p.m., Westfield High School Auditorium. And it is featuring a celestial celebration. Excuse me, it's a new ballet by guest choreographer Ken Toll, and they also have an extended version of the Nutcracker Suite as part of it, and this should be a lot of fun. Again, Sunday, 7 p.m., Westfield High School Auditorium, Ballet Theater of Carmel.
I have a couple of different things you can do at the Indianapolis Museum of Art that will get you in the mood if you're not already in the mood for the season. You can see Christmas at Lily House through January 6th, and it invites you to tour the former home of the J.K. Lilly Jr. family. It's decked out with ribbons, wreaths, garlands, and other beautiful holiday decorations that were inspired by the 1930s and 40s. You might have seen the great profile in the Indy Star a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, that was very cool.
The decorator mm-hmm. who talked about, he is also tasked with decorating the Miller House in Columbus, and he's on the hunt for just the right metallic tree and color wheel, by the way.
who isn't?
Well, you know, I'm just saying. But meanwhile, you can go to Lily House on the grounds of the IMA and flash back to the 30s and 40s. Also, think about going to the winter solstice celebration.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, that's a lovely, 20th, beautiful event they do each year.
5:30 to 8:00, and with luck, the night will be chilly as we welcome winter. And there'll be ice carving, holiday drinks, art making, bonfires, and stargazing, assuming clear skies. That's free, and you can get more on both these things at imamuseum.org.
So the winter solstice is on Thursday the 20th.
Correct.
Okay, 5 o'clock, starting with
5:30 to 8:00.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah, that's. I always hear such great things about what a nice mm-hmm. evening that is. And also, you know, at the IMA, only a couple weeks left for the Beauty and Belief exhibit.
That's right.
Running through January 13th on that.
Now, if your taste runs to the kitschy.
Yes.
I'm just saying.
Kitchen?
Not the kitchen,
okay,
but
the
kitschy. There is a T-S-C-H in there. You might want to celebrate some Hoosier holiday traditions at the Indiana Historical Society, actually the Indiana History Center, run by the Indiana Historical Society. You can have your photo taken next to the famous leg lamp from A Christmas Story, the film. And if you want to, you can dress in a pink bunny suit. And if you don't know what the heck I'm talking about, you need to go to your local branch of the library or go online and request a copy of A Christmas Story so you can see what's up and what that whole leg lamp and pink bunny suit are all about.
Okay. always lots of great book events going on at Book Mama's out in Irvington, including this Saturday, the 15th, from 3 to 5 p.m., Random Acts of Sketching. It's an open sketching session moderated by members of the Irvington Guild of Artists, and all ages are welcome. And then on Monday, the 17th, at 6:30 p.m., Ingrid Hess, the author and illustrator, is going to be signing her latest book, An Amish Alphabet. And they'll also have copies of her other books available as well, and they make great gifts for the holidays.
Fantastic. Now, something that is on display right now, but will have a big grand opening this Friday, the 14th. If you're listening to us Thursday night, you can make it. If you're listening to us Saturday morning, you can't make the opening, but you can still see the exhibition into January. It's Sophia Inger's new culmination of a year of artistic exploration and journeys. It's called Story Dome. And when you go into the exhibit, you won't be able to see gallery walls, but you'll see twists, turns, ties, and intricate connections of the Story Dome, which includes textile art, poetry, many languages, and as they say, lots more. The big opening event, not a first Friday, but a second Friday, this Friday, the 14th, 6 to 8 p.m., that's at the Indianapolis Art Center Story Dome. But the exhibit is on view through January, so you can check it out anytime.
Very, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and speaking of the Art Center, I got to see Ock Langenkeek's exhibit of paintings that are absolutely stunning.
I enjoyed your conversation.
Well, you know, and when I was talking to him about the work that he does, because the paintings, the subject matter is, it looks like concrete streets, and
right.
It's hard to picture until you actually see it, but the paintings are flat. They're not textured. It's not built up with paint. Really stunning work. Very talented. Yeah, definitely worth checking out. Beautiful exhibit. Hey, up at the Civic Theater at the Booth Tarkington, that's the Booth Tarkington Civic Theater, up in Carmel, you can go see Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. They are bringing it back. It's their annual holiday show, or their version of a holiday show, I should say, and it is running through January 5th. Right now, they've got performances pretty much every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday through the 5th. Looks like December 16th, this weekend, is sold out, but otherwise, go check out Joseph. Go, 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 Joseph.
There you go.
There you go.
Literally. Mm-hmm. So at the President Benjamin Harrison home this Saturday, there's a special family-friendly event going on. It's called Live Family Christmas, and tours run from 10 until 3 every hour and every half hour from the front door. That's what it says, every hour and every half hour.
On the hour, on the half hour.
Okay.
There you go.
I was picturing the clock and having a little wrestling match with it there. You'll have the opportunity to view the historic mansion festooned with Victorian Christmas decor, including authentic Christmas tree decorations such as wooden soldiers, cotton batting ornaments, and hand-blown glass figures. So watch the hands of little ones. Victorian toys, many of them Harrison originals, will be there under the tree, as well as traditional Victorian feather and snow trees. You'll be transported back to the year 1888, so go on the half hour or straight up top of the hour.
And the Indianapolis Children's Choir is having a whole bunch of concerts this weekend And in fact, they've got them going on Friday evening at 8 p.m., Saturday at 3 p.m., and 8 p.m. They've also got a Celebrate the Season at 12:30 on Saturday. You can get all the information at icchoir.org. But it should just be beautiful to hear all those incredibly talented young children sing this weekend. Some great hundreds of majestic voices singing holiday songs.
Fantastic. Speaking of children, you can enjoy Christmas at the Puppet Studio, and you'll probably want some children with you to fully appreciate it. It's going on through December 22nd and 27th at P. Winkle's Puppet Studio. You'll have a music-filled celebration there, and Mozart and Ludmilla, ritzy rodents who live in the piano, will host a variety of holiday characters, including ragdolls, Frosty, Rufus the Magic Elf, a live ballerina, I'm not making this up, and much more. P. Winkle's, that's plural, puppets.com, pwinklespuppets.com for more about that very family-friendly happening.
Very cool. And last thing I wanted to mention is that Cabaret at the Columbia Club is wrapping up their Martinis and Mistletoe shows this weekend with Shannon Forsell and Brenda Williams and the Baselli Walrab Jazz Septet, and they are going on Friday and Saturday night at 8 p.m., and they should be great, great concerts, Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
And don't forget, you can go down the Yule slide at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. So if your kids are feeling kind of cooped up and need to do something a little more active, but it's too cold to be outside, go over to the Children's Museum and make sure you drive by the dinosaurs who are breaking out of the side of the building on 30th Street, because they're decked out in their holiday finery.
We will be back next week with more holiday ideas of things you can do on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Pen and ink artist Franklin Booth began life as a farm boy in Carmel, Indiana, in the late 19th century, but ended up with a stellar career as an illustrator of works by James Whitcomb Riley, Meredith Nicholson, Mark Twain, and Theodore Dreiser. In his new comprehensive biography, The Colors of Black Lines, Franklin Booth's Life and Art, local author Tom Rue explored the breadth of this not well enough known artist's life, and Sharon Gamble invited Tom to our studios to learn more. He began with a short reading from the book.
As a man, J. Franklin Booth found himself in both a rural world of glorious beauty, full of blue skies, billowing white clouds, meandering creeks, tall trees stretching heavenward, and villages populated with neighbors, friends, and lovers, as well as a teeming metropolis bursting with humanity in all its many dimensions, amidst towering buildings straightening themselves higher and higher, bringing the landscape of and values of the Midwest to New York City, the nation's cultural capital. Like Janus, Booth's imaginative art conjoined these two disparate spheres of the 20th century.
What strikes me in reading your book about Booth is that he, in many ways, he was like Janus, the god who faced both forward and backward, but also like that expression about a person having a foot in each of two countries. He's this farm kid from,
right.
You know, we say Carmel, Indiana now, but, you know, in his era,
right.
It was
600
it,
people.
Yeah, it was quite rural. And I get the sense that he kind of wanted to stay home and live the farm life. And you cite, I believe it was a letter he wrote where he talks about feeling so alive, leaning on the plow or mm-hmm. you know, being out in mm-hmm. the field and breathing mm-hmm. the fresh air. And yet he's drawn to this world of visual art. And also he's a fine artist who's living a commercial life. So there's so many mm-hmm. ways in which he's living a dual
right.
identity.
Right.
I had certainly heard the name Franklin Booth, but I have to say I don't think that he has been given nearly as much credit as he should have been, nor do we know him very mm-hmm. well in Indiana. Mm-hmm. How did you first get exposed to him?
My wife and I started decorating our new condo, and we went up to Chicago to see a movie and sort of look around, and we ended up buying a lithograph of Queen Wilhelmina and had to take a 3-year loan to pay for it. But then we started visiting Nashville, Indiana, where she had a sister who had a cabin down there. And we started looking around in all of the used bookstores and basically discovered that Booth had illustrated so many other books, and that his illustrations were something that was almost better than this other art. So I began collecting his art that way. Then when I had my job at the State and United Way Association, we decided to move offices once we got a grant from Lilly Endowment to start doing some things around the state. And so I had all of a sudden a blank wall to fill.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I filled it with a big sort of samples of 3 or 4 different Hoosier artists from that era, the A. Martin kind of stuff, and then Booth was one of them. So that's sort of how I got interested in his art. I read a little bit while I was still working and discovered that there was not really a full-fledged biography of his. And so I decided that when I would retire, sort of plunge into writing that story myself.
And I want to point out, this is no monograph. This is a full-blooded, you know, several hundred-page book with illustrations in great detail. You ferreted out a lot of source material.
Well, yes, I had actually a lot of help from Howard Caldwell, who was a TV newsman here, whose father was a friend of Booth in New York City, because I don't know if that's through the Bob's Merrill Company, but it's through the advertising business. There was an Indianapolis, New York sort of connection there. And Howard Caldwell, Sr., became a friend of Booth, and when Booth died, he contacted all of the relatives that he could find of Booth and got them to send in their information about Booth. There's like personal remembering and sort of that he put together into a paper that he presented to the Indianapolis Literary Club. And that little paper was one of the things I sort of based my book on. But I also had a chance, Howard Caldwell, now still living here in Indianapolis, had collected some of Booth's art, had him in his house. He shared a lot of his father's memories about Booth and his own interest in Booth. And so that's what I think sort of tipped me in that direction.
The artwork itself is fascinating because it's based on a kind of a false assumption by Booth when he was a kid. Tell
right.
us about that.
Right. Well, as growing up in the 1800s after the Civil War, what he had to read was primarily the books if they were illustrated, they were illustrated with engravings, and he thought that was actually done by pen, and so he started as a kid. One of his, even as a for the Quaker's Friend meeting that he went to, he started taking his little chalkboard in and would give Bible stories illustrated. Bible stories for younger people. And then he went on to start pen and ink as a sort of a way to copy that line stroke kind of technique. So then when he tried to take some art courses in Indianapolis, and that wasn't too successful, he ended up going to Chicago.
And why do you think that was?
Well, at that time, newspapers were beginning to use more and more illustrations. And there was a course that was being held, I guess it was somewhere around where the circle is now. And he tried, it was sort of the forerunner of Heron Art Institute. Somebody was just coming to sort of teach you how to draw. And he didn't really think that he liked the guy's way of teaching. And so he sort of gave up on that. But then he did go to Chicago to the Art Institute there after they had the Columbian Exposition up there. And he took a 3-month course up there, came back and started messing around, and he penned one of his own poems and sent it to the local newspaper for Thanksgiving. And that was the first art that he had. Then that sort of got him interested. And then he started going back and forth between Carmel and New York City, which was pretty much the artistic literary capital of the United States at the time, trying to get started. And he finally decided that after doing some newspaper work on the East Coast there with the Muncie Syndicate, he decided to take a trip to Europe. And one of these artists sort of tours around to Spain and France. And then when he came back, then he had some sort of bragging rights that he could go to other publishers and say, you know, I've been there, give me a chance. So the Bos Merrill Company, which actually had a magazine called The Reader, which was kind of a national magazine at the time, he started illustrating material in that, illustrating stories and poems. He even did, at one point in his life, a kind of a crazy cartoon strip, which I don't find very funny, but anyway,
more whimsical.
All right. But he started meeting a lot of people in New York City, and he met Theodore Dreiser, who he became friends with, and he actually ended up doing a travel to Indianapolis and providing illustrations for the book that Dreiser wrote about that, Hoosier Holiday. But he also met Jane Wickham Riley, and Meredith Nicholson, some other people who were writing at the time, and he had got acquainted with Nicholson by doing the illustrations for one of his books that started off as a serial in a magazine, in the Reader magazine, and so that sort of got him going. Then he joined the Art Students League in New York City, which was a sort of like almost like a trade association kind of thing for illustrators. So by the time we got to 1912, he was started really doing advertising for the major magazines in the country. I calculated at some point the pre-war years of like 1912 to 1917, he was illustrating at least 2 magazine articles a month.
That's a lot.
Especially
when you consider this laborious technique.
Right.
That truly does, and listeners, if you're near a computer, just search on images for Franklin Booth and you'll see what we're talking about. It looks like either engraving or woodblock prints or lithographs, because I don't know how he kept his eyesight as long as he did, because it's so detailed. And he has such an interesting sense of scale as well. So often, you know, if it's an illustration labeled the new house, that you might have to look hard to find the house, because in the foreground there are these towering trees, and then you realize, oh, back in the distance, it's a cozy little house. So a very distinctive style.
It's a very distinctive, and in some ways, the Indiana never got out of his blood. As farmer's kid, his family had like 300 and some acres up northeast of Carmel, Indiana. And he was always out plowing these straight lines, these parallel straight lines. So I think that's sort of how it got into being so precise about this. In his illustrations, when I look at them, you can't hardly even count the strokes that he made.
And it's so interesting, too, that he grew up in the end of the Victorian era, bridged the first half of the 20th century. So if you think about living through the war to end all wars, then the Second World War, then the wars that followed, the changes in transportation, the changes in taste, because, you know, even though photographs were around when he was a child, illustrations were still the common way to enhance articles and books artistically.
Right. Well, through the 1920s, the primary medium was print. It was newspapers, magazines, and books. Radio was just starting to come along in the mid-20s, and even movies didn't have sound until later on. Reading really was the leisure time amusement of most American families. The middle class was growing, and having books around and was like a big deal. During the teens of 1900s, he was just illustrating right and left. Even during the war, he tended to illustrate poems, because some people actually think he was a poet with a pen. How they would describe him, because he had such a feeling for the story that was being told, that was in the poetry of the time, that he was trying to sort of picture that visually, these underlying themes and everything. Then in 1925, after this very successful, I've calculated his income had to be $300,000 or $400,000 a year in today's dollars, because he would get like $1,500 for an illustration. Back in those days.
Sharon Gamble with Tom Rue. Learn more about The Colors of Black Lines, Franklin Booth's Life and Art, and you can also buy it as an ebook at franklinboothbook.com. Again, franklinboothbook.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when we'll have our special annual holiday show.
There'll be lots of holiday music from lots of local musicians.
And some surprises, too.
So please listen to The Art of the Matter next weekend here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.